ॐ स्तापकाय च धर्मस्य सर्वधर्मस्वरूपिणे अवतारवरिष्ठाय रामकृष्णाय ते नमः ॐ जननीं शारदां देवीं रामकृष्णं जगद्गुरुं परपद्मेतयोः श्रीत्वा प्रणमामि मुहुर्मुहुः ॐ गुरुब्रह्मा गुरुविष्णु गुरुदेव महेश्वर गुरुरेव परं ब्राह्मं तस्मै श्री गुरुवे नमः. We were saying a few months ago, when something like this happened, we canceled the satsang, where some people came here, we can read something. Sometimes it's a God's blessing to change something, and then it changes the dynamic. Couldn't have this conversation otherwise, you know. So we read, and I think you chose the topic of discipleship, Swami Vivekananda. You know this lecture, discipleship? It's one of my favorite lectures. I mentioned that
it is in the complete works.
It is in the complete works. It's I have it here in the Yogas and the other works, which I like. It's just a nice one volume type of.
Oh, yeah,
a lot
of
the important stuff is there. It's so it's in there. Under miscellaneous, right? This is a talk he gave in 1900, March 29th in San Francisco. And we read 80% of it last time. So. And I think I liked it so much because I had a book on tape in my car of this talk. Really nicely read, you know, and I have it almost memorized because I could listen to it again and again and again and again and again. Yeah.
Well, he really gets wound up toward the end.
Yeah, he's very passionate.
Yeah.
He's very passionate.
We get to have it now.
Yeah, yeah. But so he's, I think he's mentioning that the, I think it's perfect because Buddha Purnima is next week. Next week? 2 weeks? On the 8th or not?
Saturday.
Next Saturday is Buddha Purnima. So it's auspicious to think about. Of course, we think guru, 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 guru. We have to sometimes think disciple, disciple, disciple. You know, there's a lot of talk of gurus nowadays. Very little people wondering what it takes to be a disciple. So Swamiji mentioned, he uses a Vedantic ideal, a Vedantic standard from the Shastras, which is, so it's really the qualifications for Vedantic study, Advaitic Vedantic study. So this is different traditions and different schools of yoga have a different criteria, different list of criteria, right? They call it adhikari, your qualification for study. So according to one's qualifications, one can approach and like that. So he gives a pretty, he sets the bar very high using a list of a very high ideal. First one he gave, I'm not going to read, I'll pick up where we left off roughly, but the first one, anybody remember what the first one was?
Control the senses.
Daima. What was that?
Control the senses.
That's one of them. That's good. That's a good one. The first one was to. That's also good. You're all correct. The first one he gives is, you wouldn't know, remember because you don't remember the talk memorized, but is to give up, to go beyond or give up any desire for the things of this, pleasures of this world. And the pleasures of the next world. That was the one, right? It's one thing we could see, is that, yeah, it's like, of course, I mean, we can't give up the pleasures. I mean, we eat. If things weren't tasty, we probably wouldn't eat it. If people weren't nice, we wouldn't talk. I mean, there's something, but just the idea that making the pleasures, satisfying the pleasures of the senses and the mind is the only goal, that has to be given up. Because if the goal of life is satisfaction of the senses and the desires in this world, then there's no need for Vedanta. There's no need for a guru, right? Then we need a different type of guru. You need to go to business school. You need to get a trade. You know, you learn it. And it's a different type of teacher. Somebody who teaches you what you need to do in order to fulfill your desires in this world. And then religion gets extended. The things you need. You need a religious teacher who tells you what to do to go to the next world. Right. And so many of the churches satisfy the ministers and preachers, or those type of gurus. They tell you what they understand to be the way to attain another world, heaven or some other thing like this. So Swamiji, in very strong, I love this language, he was almost ridiculing the idea of heaven. He says, oh, heaven exists, right? And what goes on, they drink their nectar and get their rheumatism, he says, right? Right, he gets it, and then he says that better there be no, it would be better if there be no heaven, you know, and he says, because then our foolish dreams would break sooner, because we have this foolish dream of this world, and then Vedanta teaches, and even some simple psychology, we know the world we live in isn't real. It's created, it's projected in our own skull, by our own, You know, it's like that we live in a world of our own creating. There's no tangible, demonstrable real world, right? So we make this, already this world is not real. And then we have some imaginary world that we only believe because somebody that we never met was by modern standards, iffy credentials, states that there is such a world, right? There's some heaven world and a limited way how to get there and like this. So even if there is such a world, and Swami Vivekananda said there's such a world, right? The Hinduism believes there's not just one world, there's so many. There's 64 heaven worlds, 64 hellish worlds, 64 worlds underneath the hellish world. There's even heavenly hellish worlds. What is it? In the Bhagavatam, it describes heavenly underworld. Underworld heaven. That under hell, there's a heaven. Right, you know, like, and so whether there's those places, the basic belief of Hinduism and the scriptures is those places exist, right? Or you can say in a very modern way, think of these are psychological states or states of consciousness, whatever it is, and the underworld heaven is a world that's so materially perfect, there's no need for God, right? That's hell, right? But heavenly, so nice, wonderful, and you can, in a certain sense, we can say we could live in California. Laguna Beach, California, heaven, right? It's heaven. Newport Beach, maybe even better. It's heaven. It's underworld heaven, you know, right? So Swamiji says that even so, there may be heaven, but that shouldn't be our goal, right? Even like this world is not our goal, right? If it is, then no need for a guru, and the other world is not our goal. If there's need, there's no need for a guru. Or a different type of guru. We don't need the type of guru, the Vedanta guru, the spiritual guru, right? Not necessary. That's the first thing. He goes very. It's a very colorful. It's my favorite part of it. He really, you know. And he says, anyways, he's and never make heaven your goal. Somebody says, you know, whatever that heaven is. And we also mentioned last time that we have to understand not to use this, because he's using a Hindu idea of heaven, which is easy to, it's built into the Hindu idea of heaven that it's temporary, starters, right? That because it's action produced. Your good or bad actions create heaven or hellish experiences, and because they're action produced, the reaction can't be different from the cause, right? So the idea of an eternal heaven or eternal hell is not there, because the thing that led to the heaven or hell is not eternal. That's a very Hindu way of thinking of heaven and hell, and therefore to show that heaven and hell shouldn't be the goal is easy. Right? It gets a little more muddled in our thinking in Christianity and in the Western religions, because although they use the language of that eternal heaven or hell that's earned or and mixed with the idea of like, even though we have a temporary action, it can lead to a permanent suffering or permanent heaven. It's not considered temporary. It's the Christian world's view. Sophisticated view of heaven is that of like union with God or beatific vision of God and or consciousness of God. We call that heaven, right? And so in that sense, and then it becomes enlightenment or liberation in the language of Western religion, right? So you can't smash that, you know, like you see the saints, they live in rapturous consciousness of heaven. They don't make heaven your goal. That you can't say like that. They're that's just the language they have for enlightenment or something, you know. So we have to be careful not to take something and bludgeon somebody to death with something that's not the wrong thing, right? But still, you can see in Western religion also for a lot of people, it's not the desire for the beatific vision and union with God that's motivating a lot of religion. That's what Swamiji is criticizing. It's wanting something better next time around. Right, you want to be happy in this world and not suffer in the next world. You don't want to go to hell, and you want something better, right? So Swamiji says it's an extension of earth, heaven, hell, and earth. He says only one name, earth. It's the world, right? He says just next by extension, you know. So that's what he means by it. And in Christianity and Western religion, that's also plays into it. Many people, that's their idea of the motivation between religion is not to suffer, go to something better, and enjoy in this life, right? But so that has to be overcome if you want to be a disciple. That's what I'm just saying. Not, of course, when all religious people desire God, and their language for God is to go to heaven and be with God, and that's overwhelming desire for that, then that's not what's meant here. You know, shouldn't overly critique it, you know. This is not criticizing Christianity. It's criticizing a school of Hinduism, mainstream Hinduism, the karmakanda Hinduism. You enjoy in this world, you do rituals and pujas in order to get enjoyment in the next world. When Nachiketa asks Yama, right, first thing he does, the first thing he learns, teach me that heaven where one can go to heaven. Right, so heavens make you go to heaven. The idea that the yagyas of old earned you heaven, right? They're merit producing, right? Sin destroying, merit producing. So you don't go to hell, and you go to heaven. You got to have better experience, you know. So that's great. I mean, that's human. That's basic psychology. That's an animal psychology. You don't want to suffer, and you go towards goes towards enjoyment, you know, or pleasure. So that's natural. Nothing intrinsically wrong with it, but it's not. A little bug there. I want to get him before he's gone. If you make it, let's see if he survives. A little termite or something. The massive fire sacrifice of the world. Speaking of that, can I have a little more tea?
So it's like he's asking us to have pure desires.
That's the thing. That's the first step, right? And I was listening to a talk today from a Vaishnava sannyasi, very powerful, upsetting in many ways and very moving in other ways. But he was a very forceful speaker, and sometimes people speak forcefully, you get riled up or inspired, right? Yeah. I was both riled up and inspired what he said. But one of the things he said very nice, he says, somebody asked a question about nishta, right? Ishta nishta, which is that when you become fixed in spiritual idealism, you know, you fix on your angas, fix on the globe, become steady, right? And he quoted Srila Prabhupada, says nishta means 75% already you're pure. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's like we start with, it's like you should have faith, you should be steady, don't be so. No, that comes from years of practice. Right. When your desires are pure, then automatically you're established, and that's one of the stages after nishta is ruchi, the taste. Thakura also describes these very high states, you know, when we become completely pure. Right? That's in the devotional schools. But so like, so it is a purification of desire. So, but the thing is, you can't like tell somebody stop wanting heaven, stop wanting. You know, it's like it's not meant. But we use this term, Baba Rampuri. It's not prescriptive. It's descriptive. It's describing the state of somebody who's qualified to become disciple. Not telling people you should be like this. Well, sometimes in emotion you can do like when you're trying to tell somebody, get pure, right? Yeah. But actually you have to be a little pure in order to be interested. You have to. These are the adhikari. This is the qualification, right? So you could see this is not. People come, you know, people go to very great spiritual masters, and what do they ask? Like, oh, please, help us. My son is drinking. Please help him. He's not doing well. My daughter can't get married, or her husband mistreats her, right? And you know, you may good. You know, we all pray for Ma. You know, people do like things like that. But that's not that you don't need that type of person for that type of. You need a psychologist and a marriage counselor or a police officer or something. Maybe better than that. You know, if it becomes something like this, you know. Or you need a job or something like that. So people have faith that yogis have connection to the divine, and people pray to them, and they give blessings. There's no doubt about that. But that's not the guru. You go to a yogi for that. You can get a blessing from a saint or a yogi, right? But this is not the motivation for going to a guru, right? Anything in this world or anything in the next world, the guru can't. The Vedanta guru, the spiritual guru, can't give you. Right, and therefore you have to. So that's the first sense. You have to give up all desires for gain in this world and the life to come. Right, and then Swamiji says, "Truth is not what we see." Right, so what we're seeing in this world, truth is not what we see. Right, what we're seeing is not true. Right, if we want the truth, we want the real. This is not it. Right, so if you want more of this, then you can get. That's called karma. You can do karma and get the result of that karma. That's more of the unreal, right? If you want to wake up from the dream, then you have to. It has to be a different motivation. Right.
once you wake up from that dream or enlightenment or realization, it's not permanent then?
No, that is permanent. Theoretically, depends on the stages of waking up. You know, you woke up this morning, but you go to sleep tonight. Right? that's a problem, right? But that's the problem, is that we wake up to a world, we wake up from an elusive world into another illusion. Right, that we wake up from our dream world, which is a made-up world and projected from our own, but to this world. But this is also a dream world projected from our own consciousness at some level. Right, so that's the problem, is that we wake up, we go to sleep and wake up with no, without too much change, you know. But the idea that if you wake up from this world to a world of that's not so generated, then maybe you can go back to sleep. I don't know. You know, they say that people can, you know, you can dream while you're, and know you're dreaming.
Or what I mean.
So I think that's
like,
sorry.
Like reincarnation, like there's a way to not be reincarnated anymore, right?
So that's that's desire. That will come as a desire for liberation, to be free from this cycle, right? Because birth and death, and this, I mean, just like day after day, we die and are born every day, right? And then we die and are born every couple hundred years, probably, or at least every 1,000 years. That happens again, you know. And so, and also, you can be born, you die and be born in another world, right? Maybe in a heavenly world or hellish world. The belief is like that, you know.
But
basic
it's not
religious.
Permanent.
It's not permanent, right? This isn't permanent, because our situation, your situation now, your experiences, your body, your mind, your surrounding, is a result of past actions. Right, those actions were temporary, and they're generating a temporary manifestation. Right?
When so then the good karma actions in this lifetime, if I do reach liberation, it won't be permanent?
It's a good question. But then because good karma, it's hard to, because the word karma is difficult, but the results of good action, the results of bad action, both have their results, both have their, those causes have a result, right? But in the yogic tradition, belief is that a certain type of experience, certain levels of samadhi, then those the seeds of those karmas are also burnt, right? Samadhi without seed, right? With nirbija samadhi. So you become aware. Then all the karma, because the seeds of all these activities, only a few are growing now. You have a big bag of right now. This is the ones that are growing now, but the ones before that will be burnt, right? Then, like this. Yeah. So then, but the ones that are burning, the ones that are activating, the ones that are growing, that we have to, you know, like, you know, if you have cancer before samadhi and you open your eyes after samadhi, you still have cancer, most likely, right? But you won't have your next life with cancer, perhaps. You know, that's the idea. That because these are, they call that prabdha karma, the actions that are already in movement. Examples given a lot is that if I shoot an arrow at you, I can ask them, please don't shoot an arrow. Okay, I put down the arrow, then you won't get hit by an arrow. But once I've let it go, it's gonna get there, right? So if you're the one, sure, to give an example of a ceiling fan, you can unplug the fan, right? And so now there's no electricity, there's no more, but the momentum is still there. Eventually, it will slow down and stop. Unless you plug it back in, it won't start again, right? So desire for next. Second condition, this is the first condition after a long talk. The second condition is that the disciple must be able to control the internal and the external senses, and must be established in several other spiritual virtues. So the other virtues are given. These are certain qualities of forbearance, and the Vedantic scriptures say equipoise, tolerance, forbearance, all these type of things, moral and personal discipline. But the primary one is that of control of the senses, internal and external, right? The external senses are the visible organs situated in different parts of the body. The internal senses are intangible. So we have the external senses, the eyes, the ears, like that, and then we have corresponding principles that animate them. And Swamiji says, very funny, he says, we have this great big nose, right? If something is bad smelling, what do? We have to smell it. We have no control. It's not even like control the senses. Like one thing is like stop. You have to control the senses, right? That's not what the normal thing of yoga. You have to. It's not withdrawal of the senses that's meant here, right? Right. It's control means make them obey, training of the senses, right? Something as big as, so I'll read it. There is a big nose. A little fragrance is there. I have to smell it. There is a bad odor. If there is a bad odor, I would say to myself, do not smell it. But the nose cells says smell, right? And I smell it. Just think what we have become. We become slaves of a big nose, right? You know, this is the thing. It's like, or you can see, it's like an untrained animal, right? Even a trained animal, a trained dog, still you have to, you can say, a trained dog is still a dog, right? As you can see, but how much easier it is to live with a trained dog, a well-behaved dog, right? So it's naturally anxious to go everywhere and smell everything. Hey, come back, get, and immediately comes back, right? If it doesn't, then it becomes impossible to live with, right? So, but to live with an untrained dog, and then you become a master, you become the servant of an untrained dog. Whatever it wants to do, you have to run after it. Mm-hmm. Right? Instead of training, it's like, come sit over here. And it sits down. Still, it's nature. It's going to get up and run. And the senses are going to want to experience. They're going to see. If we want to. But Samaji says, if something is beautiful, in front of you, and you say, don't see, even with eyes open, you won't see. It's that type of control. Not withdrawal of the sense like pratyahara, like this. That's not what's meant here. That's a different list. Right, it is a complete mastery of the senses, internal and external.
Internal, does it mean like the imprints of the senses? Oh, well, like the, you know, like, what is it, internal senses?
It's only a paragraph, I'll read it. The external senses are the visible organs situated in different parts of the body. Internal senses are intangible. We have the external eyes, ears, nose, and so on, and we have the corresponding internal senses. We are continuously at the beck and call of both these groups of senses. Correspond to the senses or sense, so it may be the Gyanindriya or the tanmata, thank you. I think it's something like those lines.
There must be deep samskaras with our senses also.
Yeah, and actually Swami Chidananda, he mentions that same also, but he has a beautiful way. He says that God gave us the senses. Right, and they're tools to bring in from. We live in this world, so the Creator created the senses so that we can live in the world. We have to interact with the world, and so if nothing was ever beautiful, if there was no pleasure attached to senses, we wouldn't use these tools, right? And so along with food, we have to eat, but there has to be some pleasure in eating. Otherwise, why eat? And then the creation wouldn't go on. If something we have to hear, but if there was no, if hearing was always horrible. Or completely insipid, then we wouldn't put any attention, and maybe it's not to our benefit, right? So along with creating senses that are pierced outward to get information from the external, so from the seeming external world, there has to be pleasure attached to it, and so that's natural. That's good, right? It's a good thing that God did this, right? Somewhere along the lines, we became the pleasure we lost because of that pleasure. We lost our ability to control it, and that we became rather than tools. That God gave us to interact with the material world, we became slaves of the tools, right? Rather than being servants, we became their servants. They're no longer like, so. If I imagine, of course, there's all the principle of the upadhi is something that adjusts what it's like. If you have a hammer in your hand, right? Like if I hold my tongue, just sitting there, I'll start. I can't help it. You have to do something with them. Right, the tool does something to the person holding it, right? And I was like, oh, I don't, you know. So if you have a hammer in your hand, you're going to bang on something, right? If you have a pen in your hand, you're going to write something, right?
You have an iPhone.
Oh my goodness, it's like the biggest. put it in my hand. Thank you. My tendency is who's paying attention to us on Facebook right now. Yeah, so not that these are big. So these are even more extensions. But just the immediate, we what to speak of the extensions based upon the senses. These are things that attach the senses to extend their influence, right? But even the immediate senses, we have no control over them, right? Someone who's no control, how can they, like in the classical yogic system, how can you withdraw the mind and focus your attention? You can't. We're complete. But the Upanishads give the example we're sitting on a chariot was pulled by five horses. I love this image so much, you know. And the sense the chariot is the body, right? The soul is the passenger. The buddhi is the driver, right? And he's pulled in the five the ego is the driver, and the buddhi is the reins, something like that, you know. And the five senses are the horses. Now imagine we have a beautiful, wonderful, sweet natured horse across the street, right? Our Bella, right? But she's not trained, right? You know, if you put her behind, if you were to attach a cart to her, right, and try to get in the cart, you're creating an accident. She doesn't know what to do. She'll freak out. You don't know what to do. She'll go here. The thing will fall over. She doesn't, you know, she hasn't been trained that way. You know, it's not her fault. It's not your fault. It's just a bad situation. So imagine if you have five senses, all going, untrained horses going in five different directions as they want, with no rein. And then you have the person trying to, and the rein that is supposed to somehow or other control them, right, which have never been used. They've never been trained to be controlled, right? But they're all tangled from lack of experience, right? And the person holding it, is described as, and the driver is drunk on top of that. You know? So the passenger is in horror, right? How are you going to get that? I mean, what do you do? I mean, that's you say everyone's just in horror, right? So your basic prayer is, Lord, get me off this, right? And hopefully, or if I die, let me go to heaven, you know? That's about it, you know? So this is not the position to approach the guru. Of course, we approach gurus to teach us how to control the senses, how to untangle the mind. You know, we have to start where we start, right? But this is the qualifications at a high level. So like that, he's setting the bar high. But we come to the guru, sometime it's, you know, it's like, it could be as simple as like, you know, go wash your hands. Yeah, it's like, you know, even something as simple as that, you know. We have to beginning the training of purity and impurity and self-control, and I want to eat that, but don't eat that until after this. It's sunset now, you should need to, you know, like there's small little things. We have to begin where we begin, right? But this is why, you know, it's like theoretically, we hear in all the scripts, somebody comes to the guru and the guru says one thing, it's sufficient. Thakur, the guru, barely finished the mantra and he screamed in ecstasy, right? When the Shakti mantra was given, his own guru didn't have that power, right? But he was so qualified, it was like, it didn't take much, he was ready. He had adhikari, he was qualified, right? So it's like, Sri Ramakrishna himself describes it as lighting a match to dry grass. Immediately it's ready, right? If you try to light wet grass, you waste a box of matches, right? There's nothing will happen, you know? So it's like, these are the adhikari, you know? So the control, Swamiji gives so many, I've lost it, here it is, hold on. The next quality of the side must be the part two. Although he says next, you know, in a thing, but it's actually not. There's actually four qualifications given the Vedanta Shastra, but this is a secondary one. One is was control the internal external senses. Next, the mind must be made to quiet down. Like, you know, so really we go to guru. How do I quiet my mind? We should go to the guru after the mind's been quieted. that's what Maji is saying, right? Right, it is rushing about. Just as I sit down to meditate, all the vilest ideas of the world come up. The whole thing is nauseating. Why should the mind think thoughts that do not want it to think? So the thing is, so it's like one thing, why do we smell we don't want to smell, see what we don't want to see, hear what we don't want to hear? Right? Let's go behind that. Why do we think what we don't want to think? That's the question. You know, we have no control of our thoughts. Right? That's a huge thing. We have to control something. Watch your thoughts. Be careful. What do you think? That's a big instruction. Thinking, that's a common in the Star Wars. I think that the guru often says, "Be mindful of your thoughts," or something like that. You can see because we lose as soon as you lose control of the thoughts. Forget the senses. The thoughts are much worse, right? Also described as a drunk monkey. You know, an uncontrolled mind is like a drunk monkey that's been stung by scorpions. That Swami Sivananda says. It's like a monkey already is fickle. A drunk monkey is even worse. That's been stung. That's been stung by bees and scorpions. That's our mind. How do you control that? Right? It's like maybe I'm revealing too much of my inner world publicly. I don't know. Maybe I should be more careful. This is allowed. It's a perfect example. I mean, a perfect metaphor or whatever. Right. So then Swamiji goes into this idea of not resisting evil, enduring everything. Control of the mind, because the thing is, in fact, something happens and we lose our center. We have no power, we have no strength in the mind to tell the mind what to do. Because the mind, we're not the body, yet the body and the body is our servant and our vehicle, yet we become servants of the body. We're not the mind, yet we've lost control of the mind, and now we spend 90% of our life trying to cat where to, like a misbehaved dog, like, where to go? Come here. There he goes. Hold on, I have to get up and go find the dog. You know, it's like the mind goes everywhere, a thousand places, you know. So how do we hear these things? And he goes and resists not even. So I'm skipping because we talked about these things. The next qualification, I think this is roughly where we left off. It is perfect for Guru Purnima. The next qualification is the disciple must have faith in the Guru, in the teacher. In the West, the teacher simply gives intellectual knowledge. That is all. In India, the relationship with the teacher is the greatest in life. My guru is my nearest and dearest relative in life. Next, my mother, then my father. My first reverence is to my guru. If my father says, do this, and my guru says, do not do this, I do not do it. The guru frees my soul. The father and mother give me this body, but the guru gives me rebirth into the spirit. We have certain particular ideas. One of these is that some are souls, a few exceptional ones, who are already freed and who are born here for the good of the world. They are free already. They do not care for their own salvation. They want to help others. They do not require to be taught anything. From their childhood they know everything. They may speak the highest truths even while they are mere babes. Right, so, of course, first beautiful thing about the guru. Now he's given an example of certain types of gurus, because we have there's gurus and gurus, right? You know, and Swami Shivananda, of course, the great gurus, like Jagat gurus, world gurus, like Ramakrishna, like Swamiji, like these are, I guess, we can't conceive who they are and what we owe to them, what the world owes to them. But not every guru is Ramakrishna, right? Not every guru is Chaitanya, not every guru is Mirabai. Right? Swami Shivananda writes in Guru Tattva, he says Chaitanyas and Mirabais are born every 500 years. Right? So it's not that everybody's some prophet, some avatar, right? But there are such people. So they're the perfect, when we want to idealize a perfect guru, we look at people like Ramakrishna and Buddha and these avatars like that, because they're the perfect example. Then we see how the ordinary guru, if there's no such thing as an ordinary guru, Jaima, please come here. Have some tea. Anyways, Swamiji glorifies these exceptionary souls, the Nitya Siddhas. Upon these free souls depends the spiritual growth of mankind. They are like the first lamps from which other lamps are lighted. That's a great thing. That these great souls, like they're like, but that great, like this is the original fire. From this, I can light something, right? I may not have the same qualities of the original fire, right? But I do have the same quality of the original fire, right? The fire gives light and heat. I now give light and heat. And from you, you light a flame, and that now you give light and heat, the same qualities of the original light and fire, right? So they may not be Chaitanyas and Shankaracharyas and Narada Munis, right? But the links in between, the ones that they come from, they're also giving the same light, right? The light that was discovered or brought by the great ones, the greatest ones, the great enough ones, pass on. True, the light is in everyone, but in most it is hidden. The great souls are shining lamps from their very birth. Those who come in contact with them get, as it were, their own lamps lighted. But this first lamp does not, by this, the first lamp does not lose anything. Swamiji, there's a beautiful scene of Thakur towards his end of his life, where he transferred power to Swamiji, right? And he said, "Oh, now I become a beggar. You have everything, right?" So, of course, that's probably not exactly true. That was a great sentimental statement, right? in that case, we should stop praying to Thakur. He doesn't have anything, right? Almost the same. You know, it's like, we have to mean, it's like by passing on the light, he didn't, the original doesn't lose anything. Right? That Purnamada, Purnamidam, from light, from the full comes the full, leaving the full full. Right? The statement, 1 plus 1 equals 1, and 1 minus 1 equals 1. in the Panagiotic language, you know. But still, we hold the original light as very important. Right? A million lamps are lighted, but the first lamp goes on shining with undiminished light. One such first lamp is the Guru, and the lamp lighted from it is the disciple. The second in turn becomes a Guru, and so on. These great ones, whom you call incarnations of God, are mighty spiritual giants. They come and set in motion a tremendous spiritual current, by transmitting their power to the immediate disciples, and through them to generation after generations of disciples. And this is the Guru Parampara. This is how it works. It's passed down. Some great soul, and passes down to his disciples. And this is how it's, exactly, Parampara is actually one of the, there's another, I don't think Swamiji mentions it here. I don't think so, but one of the classical lists in the tantras of a guru, a guru has to have a guru. That's one of the qualifications, right? Because it's not his own generated or her own generated light. It's something. It's even though it may be, of course, when if you get into illumination, it's not somebody else. It's your own light that's lit. It's your own fire that's lit, right? But still, there's something about that, how it's the authenticity of how it being passed down. If somebody has a messianic type of claim, I am the guru of the age, everybody should, I am the one going to give the new, maybe it could be, I mean, maybe it's happened in time, maybe it's one of these great souls, right? But it's a little uncertain, you know. When we sometimes think that the way the lineage is passed on, it's not only it's a realization is passed on, somebody's realized and somebody helps somebody else become realized and they pass it on, but there's other mysterious things that are passed on. Because there's mantra shakti, the power of the mantras are passed on, authority to chant, to recite the mantras, or of a technique can be passed on by somebody who's been told you have the authority to pass it on, right? Then it's not the person passing on, it's the thing, right? It's not he's illumined and he helps me illumine, that I can help you be illumined. That's ideal, right? But he's illumined, and he's given me something that will illuminate people, right? I may or may not be illumined, but I can still give it to you, right? There's that. That's the mystery of the Guru Parampara, right? Right? You know. So, like for instance, it could be a mantra, right? Of course, it's best if I have mantra siddhi. And some schools say you have to have mantra siddhi before you can pass it on. Others, the mantra siddhi becomes authority. I mean, that's also given by tradition and lineage and things like that. It's a mysterious type of thing. We have. Not everyone's Chaitanyas and Mirabayas are born every 500 years. Not every generation, right? Right. Ramakrishna doesn't come every year, although he's always here, right? But the thing is, who Ramakrishna was and what he had, that is still available now, right? And just as I mentioned, was President Maharaj's passing, that statement that the president of the order is believed to embody Ramakrishna, like a Durga image embodies Durga. Right, it's the same type of thing. You know, it's like something is put there, for all intended purposes. Right, people looking at Ma Durga, they feel they're looking at Ma Durga. If they actually saw Ma Durga, the whole world would burn away and then merge into ecstasy. But still, right, they're seeing Ma Durga. Right, so we don't see Sri Ramakrishna, we do see Sri Ramakrishna through the gurus, through the saints, through the devotees, through the mantras, through the image, through the picture. These are all also not different. So that's one. They also, the idea that about lineage also is that it's not, I sometimes think it's not a lineage of qualification, right? Because that what happened is there's one term in the term diksha itself, initiation, whatever, there's all kinds of initiation, but it's one of the ways of pulling apart is something is forgetting the Sanskrit, like, it means this and sham means that. I'm forgetting this now, but I know it's there. Is that it's sincerity plus mercy. The this is how we, that combination creates something. Some new thing is born. Some new thing is and so what it is, like, for instance, like, you don't come to the guru realized, you come sincere. You know, although here it says you should have some qualifications. Swamiji puts a high level, right? Come if you like. Puts a high level. But still, if you're already illumined, you don't need a guru, right? So you come looking for illumination. So what did the guru see? Oh, you're sincere. You trust yourself. You're approaching with sincerity, and you're assuming, minimally you assume the disciple is sincere, otherwise you wouldn't come, right? And therefore, therefore out of mercy, because, oh, then you give, you pass it on, right? But your guru, the guru who does that, he at one time was not, he wasn't born, some are born gurus, but he wasn't born a guru, most likely, right? He was born a disciple, right? He approached a disciple, so he was sincere. And his guru overlooked his maybe incomplete knowledge, but saw his sincerity and gave mercy, gave something out of mercy. And so the lineage is that of I always think of mercy, not of qualification. Although we have to have qualification, right, to like this, but at least minimally to be sincere, right? And also we sometimes think, oh, it's a guru parampara. Recently, it may have been on that TV program, but somebody made the comment that it's a lineage of disciples, not a lineage of gurus, ultimately. That's how the lineage is actually passed down, right? So those who are of sincere people, and then the mercy is passed down through a chain of sincere aspirants, right? In that chain, some will be exceptional. All of them will be exceptional, some will be exceptionally exceptional, right? You know, we shouldn't try to see differently, we see, but there's with Shakti coming down. Like, not every Durga image is the same, right? But the same Durga is in every image, right? But you can see, like, wow, that this year's image was exquisitely gorgeous. And other, like, it's like, oh, that's, how is it? It's good. It's not your favorite, but it's good, you know? So that's the thing. So it's the thing that's being given, not even the person giving. Mysterious thing. Okay, this is our guru. I think it's turned into our Guru Purnima talk. This is one of the topics I want to talk on Guru Purnima. My idea is to talk on Guru Purnima on this very topic, but we're getting there. This is practice.
Mysterious, because this is the second time that a guru has passed. Mm. It's like almost some kind of empowerment happens.
Yeah.
I don't know how to describe it, but yeah. it like uplifts your faith somehow. Like,
yeah.
I don't know, something I can't.
It's a mysterious thing. You hear, we hear, and that, oh, the guru is more with the disciple after their death, after the physical death. And it's a weird thing to say, but it is in fact true. You know, it still doesn't change the loss of the human relationship.
Right.
And there's a mourning of the relationship loss. Even when somebody dies, you're mourning the relationship, not the, you know, nobody dies.
Yeah.
You know, it's a change of relationship's painful. You know, people don't like this change of relationship. You know, so. But it's that's a universal statement, and it's 100% true. That's for sure. Yeah. So, and also, you see, like when the Durga image is with the Shakti is withdrawn, the image is thrown in the water.
Yes.
Right. It's like oh my God, Durga is gone. The mood is there. Oh, Durga is gone. You know, she's gone back. You know, people are crying, like, because the lost. They've in 4 days they've developed a relationship as an image for Durga Puja. Yeah, you know, you see, and it's
so
like it's more full, and then you have, oh, when she put in the water, she goes into the heart. I mean, we think like these are all emotional ways to describe, but it's true,
yeah.
Right? You know, it is also true. Yeah. We only got like 3-4 sentences into Swamiji this time. A bishop of the Christian Church, by the laying on of hands, claims to transmit the power which he supposed to have received from the preceding bishops. The bishop says that Jesus Christ transmitted his power to his immediate disciples and they to others, and that is how the Christ power has come to him. We hold that every one of us, not bishops only, ought to have such power. There is no reason why each of you could not be a vehicle of that mighty current of spirituality. But first you must find a teacher. A true teacher, and you must remember that he is not just a man. You may get a teacher in the body, but the real teacher is not the body. He is not the physical man. He is not as he appears to your eyes. It may be that the teacher will come to you as a human being, and you will receive the power from him. Sometime he will come in dreams and transmit spiritual ideal to you. The power of the teacher may come to us in many ways, but for ordinary mortals, a human teacher must come. and our preparation must go on till he comes. Thakur said also that the real guru is Satchitananda, that God is the only guru. And sometimes we, in exuberance of devotion, that makes, that has a cultural, a natural culture reverence or expression in Indian culture, is that, well, God is guru, therefore you treat guru as God. You see, they treat the guru, we treat the guru as good as God. But Thakur switched it a little bit. He says that God is the guru. Right, that's it's saying the same thing, but saying something totally different. It's not as dangerous, right? Because as soon as you have guru is God, my guru is God, the greatest of all gurus, right? You want God? This is God incarnated in this age to teach people the truth of Vedanta, you know. But you can see very easily it becomes like this, right? It becomes my guru is God, right? And it's true. That's a bhava. The bhava is treated like that. But the Thakur said that God is Satchitananda is the only guru, right? So God is a guru, right? But that we call it guru shakti. The guru shakti it comes through lineages, comes through books and teachings, comes through mantras. Right, and so it's the human vessel for that is important, right? But it's that which is vesseled that's important, right? It's like a glass of water. The water is the important part, not the glass. But the glass is really important. That's the only way to get water. Without water, you're not able to drink water. Without glass, you can't drink water. In a limited example, obviously. Right, but so our Guruji said something very nice. I remember, I think about it all the time and speak about it all the time. He says, so, and I was just a young boy in high school, so just assume, Bhajananda, you are a poor college student. It wasn't hard to assume, I was a poor college student. Right, and I give you, right, and I give you one check for $1 million, signed by, you know, like he elaborated, right, on a check. Now, immediately you are a millionaire. You have $1 million, right? You've become I became a millionaire. It says, who made you a millionaire? Is the question, right? Well, in one sense, you made me a millionaire, Guruji. Right? That's the point, right? And without this, before I was a poor college student, now I have a check in my hand with $1 million, worth $1 million. You made me a millionaire. So that's true. He says, or the check made you a millionaire. The money, $1 million makes you a millionaire. Right, so but the one who gave you the check made you a millionaire. You can't separate the two; they're the same thing. For all intended purposes, for emotional purposes, they're the same thing. Right. So Triparamara says, you can't separate the giver and the gift. Right. So while God is what we get, but the person that got the person that gives you God or connects you to God, that's for emotional purposes, this is good. He gave you God. If you get happiness from somebody, the person gave you, or is it the happiness that made you happy? Happiness made you happy, not the person who makes you happy. But they're so intimately connected, you can't separate them. Right, Swami Sharananda in Lila Prasanga, he says that something that's been like you imagine, like we go to the museum in Belermont, right? All of a sudden you see something. There's one cup that Thakur used on a glass case. Right, you have to be it would be too weird to bow, right? It's worshipable, right? But it's in a museum, so you can't feel weird about worshiping them. But each one of these things should be worshipped, yeah. You know? Right? At one time they were inside of shrine. They collected them. All the people, give us your relics, or put in museums and not get lost, right? A lot of people lied and told them, they only gave them certain things, you know? There's relics still in all the centers that they didn't, although they told them, give them all your relics. I remember Sister Gargi wrote letters to all the centers, don't give them all your relics. She wrote, they're going to ask for the relics, okay. They're going to ask for the relics, don't give them all, right? Because this is what makes a cathedral. You go into a little shrine of the Ramakrishna Mission, and you go to Hollywood or anything like that, and you feel like you're in a little boring building with gray carpet, right? But you feel like you're in a cathedral. There's some holy presence held there, right? These are these holy things, right? So even some little cup or something else, because Thakur used that so intimately, right? But the guru is such a thing. Thakur uses the guru in such an intimate way to bless you in such a very intimate way, and therefore we treat with such reverence, almost bordering on worship. It is worship, right? That's the thing. You worship the guru, but it's not the person. Right? But the person gets value because of what the person, what flowed through the person, flows through the person. I was just yesterday listening to a beautiful talk of Swami Shivatmananda from Chinmay Mission, one of our friends, wonderful sadhu, modern rishi. And he was saying that we have reverence for the guru until, when you go to a teacher, you show reverence until you get, you finish what the teaching, you get what the teaching is supposed to give you. Right? This is true of anything. If you go to you take a yoga class and like that, you have to give reverence to the teacher until you learn what you're supposed to learn. He says then you give reverence to the teacher for what you've learned. That's another thing out of appreciation. Right, even after liberation, we will still worship the. You worship the guru because the guru gives in order to attain liberation or realization. Upon such attainment, then one still worships the guru out of appreciation for what has been given. Like this type of thing. It's an interesting way of putting these two ideas together.
Through the practice.
Where am I here?
Because you have to give it to another.
You have to give. Well, the thing is, that you have to invest it properly, and hopefully not waste it. You can't. If you people, some people spend it and they have nothing to give, right? Or they use it properly by their own sadhana,
right.
And they increase it,
the value.
Right? Or use some, increase some, give some. We attend lectures and read books, argue and reason about God and soul, or religion and salvation. This is not spirituality, because spirituality does not exist in books or in theories or in philosophies. It is not in learning or reasoning, but in the actual inner growth. Even parrots can learn things by heart and repeat them. If you become learned, what of it? Asses can carry whole libraries on their back. A great line. So when the real light comes, there will be no more of this learning from books, no more book learning. The man who cannot write, even his name can be perfectly religious, and a man with all the libraries in the world in his head may fail to be so. Learning is not a condition of spiritual growth. Scholarship is not a condition. The touch of the guru, the transmittal of spiritual energy, will quicken your heart. Then will begin the growth. That is the real baptism by fire. No more stopping. You go on and on. Some years ago, one of your Christian teachers, a friend of mine, said, "You believe in Christ?" "Yes," I answered, "but perhaps with a little more faith." "With a little more reverence." "Then why don't you become baptized?" "How can I be baptized?" That's when somebody gets all riled up. The nature of somebody becomes this. "By whom? Where is a man that can give true baptism? What is baptism? Is it sprinkling some water on you, over you, and dipping you in water, or while muttering formulas? Baptism is a direct introduction into the life of the spirit. If you receive the real baptism, you know that you are not the body, but the spirit. Give me that baptism, if you can, or else you are not a Christian teacher. Even after the so-called baptism which you received, you have remained the same. What is the sense of merely sprinkling, saying that you have been baptized in the name of Christ? Mere talk, only disturbing the world with your foolishness. Ever steeped in the darkness of ignorance, yet considering themselves wise and learned, fools go round and round, staggering to and fro like the blind led by the blind." A famous verse from the scriptures. You think most, thinking we're wise, we're teaching ignorance. "Therefore, do not say that you are Christians. Do not brag about baptism and things of that sort. Of course, there is true baptism. There was baptism beginning when the Christ came to earth and taught. The illumined souls, the great ones that come to earth from time to time, have the power to reveal the supernal vision to us. This is true baptism. You see, before the forms and ceremonies of any religion come into being, there exists in it the germ of universal truth. In the course of time, this truce becomes forgotten. It becomes strangled, as it were, by forms and ceremonies. The forms alone remain. We find only the casket with the spirit gone. You have the form of baptism, but few can evoke the living spirit of baptism. The form will not suffice. If you want to gain the living knowledge of the living truth, you will have to be truly initiated into it. That is the ideal. The Guru must teach me and lead me into light, make me a link in that chain of which he himself is a link. The man in the street cannot claim to be a guru. The guru must be a man who has known, who has actually realized the divine truth, has perceived himself as the spirit. A mere talker cannot be a guru. A talkative fool like me can talk much, but cannot become a guru. A true guru will tell the disciple, go and sin no more, and no more can he sin. No more has he the power, no more has the person the power to sin. The chorus reference to a very beautiful image, story in the Gospels, where Jesus heals somebody and says, go and sin no more. Or even maybe the woman at the well, mature prostitute. So I forget the story, but I know the line. And he says, go and sin no more. And that person, that very word, cannot sin. Completely transformed. The power
the,
there.
The woman who got stoned.
It may have been, yes, I maybe. Go and sin no more. Right, but I mean, your sins are forgiven. Sin no more. Right. We get the problem is we go to the Ganga. We bathe them nine times down, and like every day, our sins are forgiven. I'm convinced our sins are forgiven. But so Thakur gave the example, right? Thakur said that the sins are like crows, or the sins are and when they see us going to the Ganga, they said, no, we're gonna die in there. And they wait up in the trees until we finish our bath, and they come land on us again. That's a problem. So you see, we come out the same fool we went in. That's a problem, right? Or Thakur says, like an elephant, we take a bath. You would bathe an elephant very carefully, and it comes out with a tooth. It immediately throws dirt on itself. We do that. We become pure, and then again we throw. Even if our sins are forgiven, we can't sin. You know. See, the idea, you know, if we have that ultimate experience of the Christian revelation of being liberated from all our sins, right? Then the next step, go and sin no more, right? You should be transformed by such a thing. Right? We have the emotional experience, maybe the actual experience of sins being destroyed by acceptance of something. But you know, you should be so transformed. That's his point, is that it's all the things are all there, minus his transforming power, right? In many. I have seen such men in this life. Of course, he was a disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, so we know who he talks about. That's the thing, when Swamiji's talking, you have to think who he thinks. He doesn't even mention him, but you know who he's talking about.
Yeah.
I have seen such men. Right.
But he didn't know.
Yeah, Thakur would say that they can give. They don't preach religion, they give religion. Mm-hmm. Right. We preach religion, we teach religion. I have seen such men in this life. I have read the Bible and all such books. They are wonderful, but the living power you cannot find in books. The power that can transform life in a moment can be found only in the living, illumined souls. Those shining lights who appear among us from time to time. They alone are fit to be gurus. You and I only hollow talkers, not teachers. We are disturbing the world by talking, making bad vibrations. Let us hope and pray and struggle on. And the day will come when we shall arrive at the truth and we shall not have to speak. The teacher was a boy of 16. He taught a man of 80. Silence was his method of the teacher. And the doubt of the disciple vanished forever. This is a quote. This is from the Dakshinamurti Stotram, describing the original guru Dakshinamurti. It's a verse by Adi Shankara. He's not giving you, but I know the verse. So it's about Adi Shankara, Dakshinamurti, Shiva is the original guru. He's sitting under a tree, 16-year-old boy, and around him, old men, nothing is said, and they become illumined. So he's quoting this verse. That is the guru. Just think, if you find such a man, what faith and love you ought to have for that person. Why? He is God himself, nothing less than that. That is why Christ's disciples worshipped him as God. The disciples must worship the guru as God himself. All a man can know is the living God, God as embodied in man, until he himself has realized God. How else would he know God? Here is a man in America, born 1900 years after Christ, who does not even belong to the same race as Christ, the Jewish race. He has not seen Jesus or his family. He says, Jesus was God. If you do not believe in it, you will go to hell. We can understand how the disciples believed it, that Christ was God. He was their guru, and they must have believed that he was God. But what has this American got to do with the man born 1900 years ago? This young man tells me that if I do not believe in Jesus, and therefore I shall have to go to hell, what does he know of Jesus? He is fit for a lunatic asylum. This kind of belief won't do. He will have to find his guru. Okay. Time?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Are we okay? We'll have to stop there. It's a good place to stop.
This is. Thank you so much.
We have a few more pages. Maybe we'll finish them on Guru Purnima or something like that.
Thank you.
Jai Thakur. I thought we should have started early, but I thought it was only a few pages. I would read it in 15 minutes. Is always the problem.